Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we have the very good pleasure of being joined by musician, activist, actor, author, Nobuko Miyamoto. She's been active in the struggle for Asian American rights, recognition, and dignity for more than five decades. She has also been a consistent force in the struggles for all people. At the age of two, Nobuko Miyamoto and her family were forced to join more than 120,000 Japanese Americans who were displaced from their homes and forced into internment camps during World War II. As an adult, her life revolved around music, art, acting, and activism. In the 1970s, she traveled the country and wound up on television screens playing folk music that highlighted the Asian American experience. She also worked one of the first Asian American musicals, which is called Chop Suey. She has been in a number of movies and television shows. They're just too numerous to roll off right here in the introduction, but we will highlight them as we go along. She is the founder of the organization Great Leap. It promotes Asian American performing arts. She has recently put out an album, which is called 120,000 Stories. And she's also just published a memoir that we will be in conversation about. It is called Not Your Butterfly, My Long Song of Relocation, Race, Love, and Revolution. Nobuko Miyamoto joins us over Zoom. Nobuko Miyamoto, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program. Thank you for taking this time to join us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. And I'm also looking forward to talking about your past. But I want to begin in the present. Well, what are you thinking about this moment that we are all living through?
Well, what happened on March 16th in Georgia was shocking in many ways to the Asian American community and the world at large. But it also felt like we were back at square one as Asian Americans in this country, still unknown, still nameless, still faceless. And it angered me. It saddened me. This has been a tough year. I mean, to see George Floyd killed before our eyes, Breonna Taylor, you know, all of these events are part of really the same problem. And that's called racism in America. I think we need to recognize it, that we're part of this system that has kept us in this place, in people's minds, in some people's minds, who cannot move forward. And so it's a wake-up call.
I was struck in your memoir, Not Your Butterfly, and what you begin by talking about when you were a young girl during World War II, and even before we get to the concentration camps that people were forced to go to, you were also just talking about the harassment that Japanese Americans were experiencing. And as I was reading that, I couldn't help but think about Asian Americans in this last year of the pandemic.
Yes. It's amazing how many friends that I have that one after another, you know, the stories came out, being chased in Chinatown in San Francisco, being beaten up in Oakland, Chinatown, here in L.A., the people have been yelled at and screamed at and, you know, told to go home where you belong. All of these things is really a flashback, in a way, of what our grandparents went through. The yellow peril, you know, being called the yellow peril and being othered and marginalized and, you know, with laws made against us marrying white people, laws against us owning land, laws against us immigrating. So we haven't gone too far in some people's minds. And that's a very sad statement to make after, you know, 100 years in America.
Were you writing your memoir during the pandemic, or was that all written before?
No, that was written before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which makes it even more poignant and striking.
It keeps coming around.
Like it wasn't
purposeful.
It comes
around,
yeah.
Goes around, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't purposefully written to sort of draw parallels to now.
No, it wasn't. So, and the title, being an Asian woman and being sort of making a statement that I'm not who you think I am, you know. And here this happens in Georgia. And it brought on a whole new meaning to that title and that song.
You mentioned the cities where this we see this happening. I mean, it's happening all over, as we know. But when you mentioned San Francisco, Oakland, Los Angeles, you're in Los Angeles. I'm in Oakland. Of course, California has a long history of this kind of a thing. But today, we usually think of San Francisco, Oakland, and Los Angeles as being more safe places for people. What do you think it means that it's happening in these cities? What does that mean to you?
Well, it means that there's an undercurrent that's been there and that hasn't really disappeared in all this time that we've been here. I mean, there's a, you know, the saying, you don't have a Chinaman's chance, came from the lynchings that happened to Chinese people. And here in LA, there was a huge lynching. In Oregon as well, I know of big lynching. And my own family in Idaho suffered a loss of a child who was killed as a result of a hate crime. And this was in the early 1900s. So this is not new. People have been sort of quiet about it. You know, we've been called the Quiet Americans because the tendency is for us to, you know, we've been told, like my mother would tell me, don't stoop to their level. You know, if they call you a name, don't stoop to their level. Don't say anything back. And so we sort of swallowed it and kept our heads down after camp when they took us off to camp. And then we came out. Our parents, most Japanese Americans quietly tried to go back to their lives and not make a big deal. I mean, of course it was a big deal, but they didn't even tell us stories about it. They kept it quiet so that we wouldn't live in that shadow of what happened and the shame that what happened to them. And it was really the third generation, my generation of Japanese Americans, that brought it up and said, look, we got to talk about this. This is part of our Japanese history and American history, just like slavery is part of American history. We need to talk about this. And so people actually organized going back to the camps and making pilgrimages and revisiting that story and opening the pain again and finally going for redress and reparations. And that was a struggle in the 80s that was very, very significant in bringing out the stories, but also making America, the United States, to make an apology of stripping our rights and, you know, the stealing of land, possessions, etc., that happened, and time and dreams, dignity. And here, you know, now in Chinatowns and other places, again, people are treated without dignity, you know, being pushed, being shoved, you know, being called names, being beaten. So it is time you're seeing people rising up, people saying, we've learned, we can't just be quiet, we're not going to be bullied. So it's a good thing in that way that it's made us realize that we can't be silent. We can't be invisible. We have to tell our stories. We have to be known.
Yeah. It seems like now, right now, is a moment for that. Are you frustrated by that at all, though, that it took for this, for these stories to be told, for even us reaching out to have you on, you know, the show, right? I mean, obviously it is connected. I like to think we would have had you on anyways, but obviously there is now a connection in which everyone's talking about.
Yes, it's a sad thing that it takes a moment like this for people to pay attention. I mean, this, for to be an Asian woman and to be a person who was part of the entertainment industry with my dreams and my training, I can tell you that we were marginalized and kept on, and the stories they told using our bodies and our skills were not our stories. And it's only in this present generation that has really been able to sort of push their way into the film business and the television business to begin to tell other stories. We're not spies. We're not geisha girls. We're not, you know, maids and servant boys. We're not, you know, these weird characters created with our faces. We're not the enemy. We are families. We have stories. You know, we grew up just like everybody else, you know, with challenges and problems, and had to overcome different things. But we don't see those stories, you know. So we're still the perennial foreigner in the minds of many people in the United States, because the media has portrayed us that way.
A long history of that. We'll get into it. In your memoir, Not You a Butterfly, I was struck. You begin the memoir by talking about the World War II, the internment of Japanese Americans, what happened to you and your family. And what I was really struck by that was you had already had two generations of your family already living in the United States, mostly in California, though not exclusively. I mean, you were a third generation Californian.
And I was only 2 years old. Yeah. How could I be the enemy? How could I be an alien, you know, spy, you know? So obviously it wasn't just about that.
And you were 2 years old, but you were there for how long were you in a camp?
So we were among the people that were sent to Santa Anita Racetrack, which was a temporary holding zone with more than 10,000 people.
And this is Southern Los Angeles. Yes, Southern California. You're from Los Angeles.
It's about an hour outside of LA proper. And we were there for several months until the camps were being built. But then they started recruiting men into the army, and also recruiting to harvest sugar beets in Montana. And my father, he said, I'm not going to, you know, volunteer for any army after they put us in camp. Are they kidding? And he volunteered to harvest sugar beets in Montana. So we were part of a group of men. Me and my mother were sent with a group of men to Montana to work, to be on this work farm. So we sort of escaped at that point. We were still, behind barbed wire and barracks, basically. And my father had to work. But because my mother approached the foreman and said, look, we have a place to go in Idaho. So if you had a place inland to go, there were people that got out of camp early. And so we were able to go to Idaho, because it happens to be that this foreman happened to be from Idaho. And it happened that he asked my mother, well, who are your people? Where do they live? She said, Parker, Idaho. He said, I'm from Parker. And he said, what were your people's name? And she said, Miyamoto. And he said, Harry Miyamoto? And it turns out that he was at my grandparents' wedding. And that's why he helped us get out of there.
That's an important point. Well, it's an important point. And I think a lot of people today, who are not alive during this period of time, may not realize, it was Japanese Americans who were on the West Coast who were interned.
Yes. So it was everybody who lived not only, in California, but Oregon and Washington as well. So it was those people that were moved. But there were people in Arizona that were also in camp. Not all of them, but some of them who lived on one side of a line and the other side of a line. I mean, there were some really arbitrary things that made this happen, and that who was in and who was not in. And then later we learned, we figured out that Japanese Americans or Japanese people had cleared land in California, and the most valuable land and an industry that was on the rise, and they had the chance to gain economic power. And there were white farmers and others who were angry about that fact and pushed to have us removed. That was a big part of it.
More than just the war hysteria.
Absolutely. That was, in a way, a convenience to allow them to do that. The fear of us, of our people who had worked to clear the land and work the land and were farmers from Japan that knew how to grow rice and other things, they didn't want that. That was no secret.
You were talking about your dad. You'll forgive me because I confuse a lot of details. Was he the baseball player?
Well, he wanted to play baseball. He played baseball when he was in a high school, Hollywood High School. Yeah. And because Japanese, if black people couldn't play baseball, of course Japanese people couldn't play baseball. Yeah. So there were black leagues and there were Japanese leagues. And my father played for a Japanese American league, and he was a ambidextrous pitcher.
So he pitched with both hands?
He played people like Satchel Paige, Yeah.
Oh, he did. He went up against Satchel Paige.
Yes.
The great Negro League pitcher. Eventually, he would get into Major League Baseball, but when he was much older. But
yes.
I never knew that about the Japanese American leagues. And there was,
popular.
Yeah. That was a neat story. I was really amazed by your recollection of what happened when you were a young girl during World War II. Are these things that are just seared into your memory that you have available to you, or did you have to research? How did you tell this story? How did you go about telling the story?
Well, my mother. And a lot of mothers are the storytellers in the family and the memory keepers. So my father talked little about his family or his life, early life, but my mother kept these stories alive. And the ones that I couldn't remember and that I knew I had to know more about, I, of course, researched. But she had the seed of many, many stories and histories of, when she was sent to Japan as a child, and 1924 was coming when they were going to close the door to Japanese immigration, her mother came back to Japan after almost 10 years of not being with them and brought them back to America. So the significance, my family lived many of these events that were significant. They were affected by these major events that were and laws and barriers that were created, like my grandfather who married a white woman, and that was a time when, say, it was probably around 1910. It was against the law to marry a person of color. A white person could not marry a person of color. I don't know how they did it, but his son in Utah could not marry his white partner. And went to California to try to marry her and couldn't get married in California either. So, yeah, our family was much affected by many of the laws. And, of course, my grandfather could not own the land that he had cleared in California. So, and my father's father worked for the railroad. I don't think he was actually, you know, work with the Chinese. He came a little bit later, but, you know, that connected me to the idea, because I'm looking at the pictures of the end of the railroad where the Southern Pacific and the Union Pacific are come together or whatever. And I realized there's no Asians in that picture. And the China, you know, that the Chinese had the technology to, and many of them died while trying to build, while working to build that railroad. And then they brought Japanese in, where my grandfather came in after that. So, you know, we've been sort of part of American history and the developing of the West.
This is Letters and Politics, and we are in conversation with Nobuko Miyamoto. She is the author of a memoir on her life called Not Your Butterfly, My Lost Song of Relocation, Race, Love, and Revolution. You piqued my interest when you talked about what happened during World War II. As your parents, this was something they didn't talk about. And this is something I think we find a lot with sort of that generation, and that it would take your generation to start to tell these stories. When did you start to tell these stories? What was it like for you growing up and very early on in life? I think you were a teenager, and you'll correct me if even before, you were, you know, acting and performing and being involved in the arts. How did you come to the point of needing to tell these stories?
Well, as someone who was trained in Western arts, ballet, you know, I'm working in the film industry and Broadway, I realized that the stories that we were telling were not about who we were. And also the jobs that were available to us as Asian Americans, which there weren't a lot of Asian American performers, because who wanted to let their kids in a business like this? You know, it was a very risky business. But it wasn't really until the 60s and seeing Black people rise up and the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement, and then Asian Americans, because of the Vietnam War, began rising up and saying, we need to find voice. We need to talk about the injustices that happened to us. And that's when it began, in the late 60s. The Third World Strike in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, Asians were standing up with Blacks and Latinos for ethnic studies programs. We needed to have our stories to hold. And it happened to be that I had really given up. I mean, I had given up on show business. I said, forget this, you know, and it happened to be that I helped Italian filmmaker Antonello Branca make a docudrama about the Black Panthers. And it was then that some of the Panthers actually recognized that our story, oh, you guys were in camp, you know, they can do that to us too. No. And there was a recognition that from them and from myself, oh my God, they can see that I have a story too. I come from an oppressed people too. But it wasn't until we were in New York shooting at the Young Lords Church. The Young Lords party had taken over church so that they could have a Breakfast for Children program there. And I was there filming with Antonello, and I met Yuri Kochiyama. And Yuri was a Nisei, second generation. She looked like an auntie, you know. She had a little pencil in her, above her ear, you know, always with a notepad, talking to people, you know, taking notes. And I thought, who is this woman, you know? And she came up to me and she said, who are you? Why are you here? And where are your parents from? What camp were they in? I'm going, wow. Is she a reporter or what's going on, you know? And she was the one lone Asian in this whole sea of Latino and Black people. And she introduced me to the Asian American movement. She brought me to Asian Americans for Action, and they were very progressive. Group of both Nisei and Sansei, Chinese and Japanese Americans, who were taking a stand against the Vietnam War, as well as the U.S.-Japan Treaty and other issues, recognizing the alliance and solidarity needed with Black people at that point. This was 1970. So this is not a new idea.
As I mentioned earlier, as a teenager, you were appearing in films. You appeared in the King and I in the 1950s. West Side Story, did you leave Hollywood? Did you leave mainstream film purposely?
Well, it left me, but it also, I left it. I realized, early on I was, because I had really, I was a well-trained dancer and I had big dreams for myself. And I thought I wanted to cross the color line. I thought being twice as good would, and the training that I had, because I was a scholarship student at a really fine academy in Los Angeles, and which prepared me for many things, including for a ballet company. And then I started getting these jobs. King and I was 15 years old, working for Jerome Robbins, who really admired Asian culture and used Thai dance in that ballet sequence, you know, to tell the story of Uncle Tom's Cabin. So it was an interesting mix of cultural form and storytelling to tell a story about slavery. But when you go back and look at it again, then you say, wait a minute, the bigger story of The King and I was about a white woman coming to working in Thailand for a king and trying to promote democracy, you know. And he happened to be a character created with respect, which we had not seen before. So, I mean, that was sort of an unusual situation, but it was a film that was later banned in Thailand because they didn't like the way they were telling that story. And anyway, so as I took other jobs, like Flower Drum Song on Broadway, I realized that we were sort of, and I was basically standing on the stage, you know, looking out at this audience of little white ladies, and I realized how they looked at us, that we were Chinese food for white people, that they came to be entertained and they wanted to see us in a certain way. And our bodies and our images and our what we were saying and singing really was entertaining to them. But it didn't represent who we were, you know. And West Side Story happened to be because I had worked before for Jerome Robbins as a young person, and because I could dance and I could pass for Puerto Rican. I got in West Side Story, but that was really a very exceptional situation that I got in there. And of course, you know, in Puerto Rico, there are Asians who came to Puerto Rico and Cuba, et cetera, and you know, we're mixed bloods, et cetera. So it wasn't so unusual for somebody to be a Chino, you know. Yeah. One of the characters, Chino, in West Side Story, was a mixed blood. He was Filipino and Guatemalan, actually. Jose de Vega. So, but in real life, there are these mixtures, so it's not so far-fetched. But I will tell you that even in West Side Story, there were things happening in West Side Story that made me say, well, that some of the cast members were darker and could not stay in the same apartment building that the white or the lighter skin performers were in. It was actually segregation in Los Angeles, where the hotel or the apartment owners did not want the people with darker skin and curly hair, nappy hair, to be staying there. And that was like a wake-up call to me. I mean, you realize, you know, here we are, we're working together on a movie about racism and divisions, and this is happening in real life. So, you know, I was lucky because I began to study singing, voice, and my African-American teacher, and this is the 60s, you know, and we're looking at the world, you know, together. He's telling me stories about, you know, what it was like to grow up in Washington, D.C. and have to sit in the balcony because black people could not sit in the first floor of the theater, in the movie theater. You know, I talked about camp. So then I started really beginning to see how black and Asian people had a common story. And I also then began to see how black women, singers who were powerful and who could be themselves and who could sing and interpret music the way they wanted to interpret it and also make music like Nina Simone, Mississippi Goddamn, you know. This was unusual. This was powerful to see.
Did that influence you in your
Absolutely.
Music?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I didn't know it, you know, consciously until a few years later when I actually got in the movement. And then when we started, and I didn't think about being a singer in the movement. I was passing out leaflets. I was organizing. I was on the street with everybody else. I was marching. But informally, like, after somebody picks up a guitar, somebody who's actually a great guitar player and a songwriter, Chris Hijima, and we started playing around and we just stumbled into writing a song together. And that stumble really became a moment when we saw and we performed for our own people and we realized, oh my God, this is a song we never had. This is a song we were waiting for.
You're talking about the duo that you were a part of, Chris
yes,
and Joe, in the 1970s.
Hijima. Yes, yeah.
When we first saw your memoir, Not Your Butterfly, My Long Song of Relocation, Race, Love, and Revolution, I immediately looked up the name, your name, Nobuko Miyamoto, online, and up came Chris and Joe on YouTube. Being introduced by John Lennon. And I was like, oh yeah, we'll do this. Let's do this.
That was another stumble. I mean, Yoko Ono happened to be the cousin of somebody very active in the movement. I don't know how she heard about it, but so, you know, they invited us to do that show, the Merv Griffin show or something. I don't know. It's one of those talk shows. And that's another story. Behind that story is another story. But yes, we performed on national television, and they didn't really want us to sing We Are the Children. We sang We Are the Children. And when we were in the rehearsal, they stopped us, and the director stopped and said, I think maybe that line, watching war movies with a next-door neighbor, secretly rooting for the other side, it might seem like it's subversive. And I'm going like, wait a minute, you've got Bobby Seale on the show, Jerry Rubin's on the show, and you're saying that this line is subversive? Are they kidding? It was crazy. And they kept pushing us. And then John Lennon came up and he says, well, can't you just fudge the words a bit? And I went, what? And the director came up again. And I just lost it. And I never lose my temper. But I lost it. And I said, you, pointing at the director, you put us in concentration camps and you're saying we can't sing this song. And I just walked away. And I thought, I'm going to have to walk back to New York City. We were in Philadelphia. And then he chased after me and said, no. Don't worry, you can sing anything you want. But it took that, me having a fit, you know, to get the truth out, to be able to sing a simple song, you know, that we wrote. So, you know, you do have to fight back. You do have to stand up. You do have to say, I'm not going to do this unless I get to do it my way. And I think that's something that performers of color have had to fight since the beginning, you know, to say it and sing it in their own way. And it's been a struggle.
You're responsible for bringing these two people to us, so why don't you handle their first introduction to nationwide television, John?
Yeah. These are two young people that they call themselves Yellow Pearl. Their grandparents were Japanese, I guess, and they're young singers called Chris and Joanna, and beautiful singers, and they have a story to tell. They're going to come on now and do it. Here they are, Yellow Pearl.
Usually, people know very little about Asians, and this is a song about our movement, about our people's plight in America.
We are the children of the migrant worker. We are the offspring of the concentration camp, sons and daughters of the railroad builder who leave their stamp on America.
Amazing story. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned about your years of activism, and were you at all involved in the activism to get Earl Warren to apologize for Japanese internment?
The struggle for redress and reparations was more than just Earl Warren.
Yes.
It was really about getting the U.S. government to realize, and this happened in the 80s, to listen, to getting them to hear the stories of Japanese Americans who were actually in camp. And that was a difficult struggle because Japanese Americans who were in camp, a lot of them didn't want to talk about it anymore. And those who, younger ones who were pushing for it, had to really nurse people along and organize carefully and hold hands and help write out stories in order for the people to stand up and in front of the commissions with senators and congresspeople listening for the first time. So, I wasn't directly involved in that because a lot of things I could not do. I was a single mother. I was running an arts organization, but my way of participating was writing. I wrote a song called Gaman, and I made performances that were about that experience. And so that became my way of participating through the work I was doing in the community and through the community and serving the community. I really saw that what I was doing was part of that struggle. Yes.
Yeah. The better way for me to have asked that question is tell me about the struggle for Japanese reparations. But the reason I brought up Earl Warren was I had read in the past year a biography on Earl Warren, and I approached the book thinking, like, okay, here's this Supreme Court justice, who is behind a lot of Supreme Court decisions that would, in the law anyways, try to advance a more equal society. And what I came into as well, he was also governor of California before that, and either attorney general or a top legal official in California during the World War II, who was supportive of the internment of Japanese Americans. And it surprised me, for everything that Earl Warren would be known for later on in his life, that for decades, Japanese Americans were seeking an apology from Earl Warren, something that he never did. He refused to do.
I think everything has to be looked at in the context of the times. And perhaps he didn't change, or maybe he had to defend. I didn't read that book, but I think it's pretty interesting that he did later become a person who stood for a lot of progressive ideas. I mean, the same could be said about Roosevelt. I mean, we think of him as more of a progressive president because of all the programs that he did, but he was the one that signed the executive order to put Japanese in camps. So, yeah, the hysteria and the pressure that was coming at the government and within and around the government created the atmosphere to make that happen.
Is there a lesson in there, and something that you think is important to be mindful of today when we talk about people like FDR or Earl Warren, people who are largely revered today, but yet also have the internment of Japanese Americans on their hands?
I think people in high places, and even Obama, don't always have the power to do what they personally believe, or they are not convinced to do what they personally believe, you know, in order to stay in power and or just to stay where they are. And that is where the power of the people and the pressure of the people come into play here, and why we cannot stand down. And when we believe something, and for that reason, Japanese Americans now are standing up to support H.R. 40, which is looking into the reparations for African Americans. And there's a sense of we have a moral responsibility because of what happened to us, and also because what we learned in organizing for reparations for Japanese Americans could be shared with the Black community as a means of, you know, tying our histories together in a useful way.
You are the mother of a Black and Asian child. Black-Asian unity has been something that is obviously instrumental in your work, activism, and artistic work. Talk to me about that and how important it is to you and your thoughts of it today.
That was one of the most difficult and the best decision I ever made in my life. To have a child that was African-American, and at that time I didn't know whether I would get married or not, and then as fate and the world would have it, his father was killed, and when he was 10 weeks old. So I always felt the sense, and he was an activist. He had worked with Malcolm. He was part of the Republic of New Africa. And I always felt the sense of responsibility that they took this wonderful spirit away, that I had an extra responsibility to make up for that loss.
What was his name?
Atala Ayubi. So, you know, it was very, you know, I wanted to raise a son who knew who he was, yeah, and who he is and where he came from. And so, you know, I connected deeply with his family after he was killed, and we have, we are still family, and I've learned more about African American history from sitting at the feet of his mother and listening to her stories of growing up in the South and then coming to Harlem and then living in the Bronx. All of those stories that really filled me with a sense of responsibility and love and culture and connection that I really wanted to share. And because that helped stretch my life and grow my child. And, you know, wherever I was, and mainly we were in L.A., and I grew up in a Black community, and Leimert Park, which was the sort of became the epicenter of Black culture in Los Angeles, that's where I gravitated to and became part of that community, because that was a place that I could be both Japanese and the mother of a Black child and feel perfectly comfortable. So, yeah, so I actually, one of the songs on this latest album, 120,000 Stories, is called What is the Color of Love? And it describes my watching my son grow up as a child who loved to paint and draw on everything. And so I use that as a metaphor for his questions about who he was and what, why people hated Black folks so much. You know, how do you answer those questions?
Nobuko Miyamoto has been our guest. She is an artist, musician, singer, actress, activist, writer. Her latest album is called 120,000 Stories. And her latest book, it is a memoir, is called Not Your Butterfly, My Love Song of Relocation, Race, Love, and Revolution. Nobuko Miyamoto, you also have an event coming up at a local bookstore near our radio station in Berkeley.
I'm going to do a book event at East Wind Bookstore in Berkeley. And it's going to be on June 26th. It's going to be one of the first events. The book is coming out on UC Press. You can order it on Amazon or whatever, or better, just go to the bookstore. Support your local bookstores. So on that day, I'll be able to share some readings and some relationships with people from the community and activists that I've worked with to talk about our journey and making the Asian American story part of the American story.
Nobuko Miyamoto, I thank you for sharing your story with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that does it for Letters and Politics. If you'd like to see the video of today's show and or share it with other people, you can do so by finding the Letters and Politics page at kpfa.org. You can also search YouTube by looking for Letters and Politics and finding our page there. If you do, make sure that you subscribe. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I thank you for listening.
Color of love. Of love. I have a son, and colors run through his bloodline, into his crayons, his pencils, charcoals, watercolors. painting his toys, his notebooks, walls, furniture, painting a world he wants to live in, painting a world he wants to live in. Now, being a boy of colors, hard questions. He asked the ones I never asked. At 6 years old, I took him to the beach with a friend. A blue sky watched over them as they built castles in the sand.